Hello, this is Katie. Anybody there? Why am I not hearing anyone? I'm seeing Michelle. I'm seeing Jenny, I think. Can you all? I can't hear anybody saying anything. What is going on? This is very strange. Chat as co-host, sure. Yeah. Make sure we're unmuted on your end. Yeah, you should be unmuted on my end. I'm showing your little live microphones. I'm really confused here. Well, if anyone is listening, we seem to be having technical issues for a second. This is the SED 584 radio show. I don't know. Michelle, can you hear me? I got your text, but you're not actually texting me back. Okay. Well, it sounds like people are hearing me. Why is this not working? Okay. Live, mute, yep. Unmute, strange. Very, very strange. I wonder if we should try having you all call in again. Or maybe I'll just throw you out and then you have to. How about that? Okay, well, I've just kicked Jenny and Michelle out. Hopefully they'll call back because they did hear me, so someone must be listening. But for some reason, our dashboard is not working and letting them join. But I couldn't join by my normal online join, so I'm on the phone. Okay, there's Jenny. Try this
again. Can you hear me now?
Ah, now I can hear Jenny. Michelle?
Okay.
Hello.
Hey, there we go. Well, welcome. Sorry about that. I don't know what's going on, but everything is a little wacky this afternoon, apparently, here on our end, on the technology end. Well, okay, let's start this over again. Welcome to the third radio show for SED 584 in spring 2015, the Physical Dimensions of Free Choice Learning. I'm your host, Katie Stouffer, coming from the University of Florida. I have with me co-host Michelle Milam, certificate instructor, and our guest today, Jenny DeLaos, who is going to tell us a little bit about what she's been doing lately. Before we start that, Michelle, do you have any housekeeping issues for your students or anything?
I don't think that I do. I want to encourage everybody to just keep moving forward. We made some slight changes in the certificate portion of this course to kind of lighten the load as all these people are moving into the busy summer museum season. So just look, you know, for all of my students, look at the announcements and see the changes that we're doing there. But just remember to keep having fun with these assignments. I think we had another fun one this module, and starting next week we'll be going into the final project.
Great. Yeah, I would say we haven't made any big changes in the master's program degree program version of the course, but everyone, for the most part, seems to be keeping up. Haven't had, seems like, any major issues with this past assignment, and I'm hoping the same for this week's assignment. We did have a couple of kerfluffles with rooms and things last week, but I think they got all resolved. And, yeah, I guess I had more questions about last week's assignment, so perhaps perception of smells and things is easier to wrap your head around. Or maybe it's just because it's the second kind of prototyping assignment in this course that people are starting to get the hang of it. I guess we'll just dive right in and welcome our guest then. As I said, we've got Jenny De La Hoz, who's filling in at the last minute for our scheduled guest, who unfortunately had a family emergency and has gone out of town. She offered to reschedule, you know, later in the course when she's back in town, and we may maybe try and do a shorter optional radio show just because I think she has some really interesting things to say. We'll see if that's a possibility with her. But let me introduce our guest for this week, Jenny De La Hoz, who is a PhD candidate, almost finished with her work there at Oregon State. And she and I overlapped by a couple of years, and I'm thrilled to be able to learn more about what she's up to for her dissertation and have her talk to you a little bit about what she did in her work as a museum educator at Monterey Bay Aquarium and all the exciting things she's up to. So, Jenny, tell us, you know, what are you up to? And also, I'd say start with a little bit more background on what you've done up to this point. I think people are really interested in that story as well.
Okay, well, thanks for having me. Let's see, I actually started my career off as a high school teacher in Tucson, Arizona. But I always had a dream of doing marine biology, and so an opportunity presented itself for me to do an internship first at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute and then at the aquarium, and I took the opportunities. And from there, it stemmed into a 13-year career at the aquarium where I created bilingual programs, both what people would consider like the classroom programs and also floor programs, so any type of programming that visitors would encounter. My job there was to create those types of programs, in addition also bring in local communities, particularly underrepresented audiences, into the aquarium. And I did that through programs and through various other partnership programs that the aquarium had. But after many years of doing that and kind of Based in some research, I felt like there wasn't enough research that I was going off of, so I decided to come back and get my PhD and really understand what it was about museums, zoos, aquariums, informal learning centers, really, free choice learning centers. What is it that would be attracting underrepresented audiences, and why they were not coming? And so my current research right now, my dissertation work, is just getting to a small snippet of it, where I'm starting to understand, I'm interviewing environmental professionals, specifically Latinos in the environmental profession, finding out what attracted them to the environmental field and what created their environmental identity, and then see if some of the same traits are then present in the larger Latino population. So that is my current work right now.
Great. Well, so, you know, related to the physical dimension, and specifically this week we were talking about emotions and senses and things like that. You know, obviously with the environmental movement, there's, I think, a lot of emotion kind of tied up with why people get involved and some passion and things like that. So I don't know if that you feel like is maybe a more related place to start, or if maybe going back to your programs at the aquarium, I know one of the pretty popular things at most aquariums are touch tanks and the sense of touch. But maybe tell us how you see sort of this role of emotion or senses kind of playing into the work that you've done so far.
That's a really good question. I think you know, one of the things that as a person of color in the museum field and also in the environmental field, I often felt that there were certain perceptions that were not either appreciated or as readily accepted in those mainstream areas. And I'm still having a hard time quantifying it, but I'm starting to get more and more more closer to it, I think, as I continue to do my research. And one of the areas that I was particularly, I'm particularly like right now honing in on, as far as emotions are concerned, is the emotions that people attribute to nature or environmental spaces. And often, you know, people who, when they think of environmental or natural spaces, they think of peaceful and serene. And that is a very mainstream perspective on the way to interact with a natural space. You go there, very John Muir, you go and you meditate over a space and you think about a space, you feel in communion with the space. But I also, I often felt that that didn't reflect my personal experience, all of my personal experience, nor that of some of the people that I was talking to, especially when I talked to families that I needed to convince them to let bring their daughter or and or their son, allow them to come and do a program with me, and their parents would be very scared of having them out on the ocean or having them go out into nature, or, you know, they'd be scared about the possible threats that they perceived would be happening in a natural environment. So it was contradictory to me, where the mainstream environmental movement was like, it's a peaceful, serene place. And my audiences were like, that's a very scary place. And so it's something that I'm starting to tackle in my research right now. But it's something that I think we need to be aware of as educators, that with the mainstream maybe perceiving a certain emotion that is tied to a certain space may actually be contrary to the way your audience is perceiving it. And I don't think fear, for example, in this situation, fear is the full measure of the emotion. I think that there's an initial fear, and I think then there's a wonderment and curiosity that underlies the fear. But it's treated differently, and it can be perceived as a cultural or socioeconomic or sociocultural, really, perspective that some audiences bring to certain environments. And as educators, we have to be aware of how our environments are being perceived by our audiences, and how they may or may not be, how it may or may not taint their experiences in our environments.
So how are you... That's really fascinating. How are you uncovering that? You're doing interviews. Is that something that you're asking people directly, or how are you getting at that methodologically?
Methodologically, the way I don't want to approach it straight on, because I think what has happened for many of us in who are now perceive ourselves as part of the environmental movement. We have taken on a lot of the same characteristics, traits, ideologies that the mainstream environmental movement is currently, you know, in order for you to be an environmentalist, you have to have this type of experience in nature. So I didn't want to necessarily ask straight up that question. So I'm kind of going around another way that environmentalists or people who consider themselves close to the environment, the way that they perceive themselves as part of this movement or part of this culture, is that they tell stories about their connections to nature. And so I'm interviewing people and asking them about, tell me about some pivotal experiences in nature that for you that either were prompted by people, experiences, ideas, places, that prompted you to consider yourself an environmentalist or prompted you to really have a strong environmental identity. And as I'm slowly going through these interviews, what I'm starting to notice particularly for these Latino professionals, and of course this is very early in my findings, but that many, I have to say, none of them have ever mentioned being alone in nature as one of the main pivotal reasons why they feel close to nature. They talk about being in nature with their families, being in nature with like-minded friends or colleagues, with people that are enjoying it with them, and there's a give and take of the experience. And that's a very different picture than John Muir painted for us. So if that were the case, then what I would then do, if this is what the final finding is going to be, then I would then, as an educator, have to rethink about the way that I approach nature when I bring kids and or families to natural environments. Consider how do I make it so that it's not only about being quiet in nature, because I think being quiet, surrounding a natural environment, is an important thing to do, but also how do I encourage that interaction, that talking, that experiencing together, so that it can be part of that environmental identity.
So that brings up a question in my mind. When I was going through this series of courses, I don't think we spent a lot of time weighing them one against the other, saying something like, oh, well, in this situation, the sociocultural is more important, or in this situation, the physical is more important, you know? And in some ways, separating them into three different courses maybe makes it an artificial sort of thing. I mean, but what I'm hearing from you, Jenny, is that you're really seeing, you know, again, this sociocultural influence kind of interplaying with the physical, and maybe with a different culture, the mainstream environmental, I'm going to assume mostly white culture, maybe mostly female. You talk a little bit more about it maybe being a personal and individual connection with the physical. Is that, would you say that's a fair characterization, or am I, you know?
I think you've hit it right. I think, you know, the beauty of separating the courses like they do is because then you get to really focus on one particular area at a time. But the fact is, as you know, as well as I do, Katie, that when you're actually in praxis, you know, you're actually practicing your knowledge, all of those come into play. And so, you know, the skill that we then bring, and that the reason why the educators, the people who are taking these courses, are taking these courses, is to make them more knowledgeable and better diagnosticians about what their audiences are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to compare, let's say, if we were to just make a very simplistic monochromatic color of, or just one modality, we're going to just look at one modality and look at how that modality plays out. Let's just say we were looking at language, and we were looking at language and then people using language as they come into our environment, into our museums, zoos, or aquariums, and then we start exploring that modality. Well, those of us who have done any type of research in that realize that the language in and of itself is very rich and also limits or opens up conversations depending on what the language itself, how the language is constructed. So, for example, if someone from where I'm originally from in Colombia, my mom was from the inner part of the country where they didn't have any sand dunes. So if I brought her to a sand dune and then she went back and explained it to people in Colombia, in her part of Colombia, they would have no clue what she's talking about because they have no experience. And thus, the language is like that. Language, you know, you have to have the language and the experiences in order for you to be able to weave them through. So studying each of them individually helps you get better at diagnosing it, but it's really about bringing them all together and the interplay of them together that makes you, that really talks about the full experience. So I hope I answered that question.
Yeah, and yeah, I can jump in there too. Oh, sorry, Katie.
No, please.
Because I was just going to point out what the actual contextual model of learning looks like, as John and Lynn proposed it, was that
right. It
is these three circles that, you know, are all crossing over at one central point, and it, you know, and they make it very clear that that one point is where meaningful learning happens. So I think Jenny did a great job of answering. It's really, I think, important to focus on each of them, but it's really the accumulation of all three that we as practitioners and researchers have to consider when we are considering our audiences.
Sure. Yeah, and I guess I was trying to wrap my head around how that, you know, and again, they present it as, you know, in a book, it's a static picture, right? But I guess I'm thinking of it as circles that grow or shrink or overlap in different ways for different people. So that meaningful space in the center that you just described, Michelle, is, you know, looks different for different people. And I guess I was just having this conversation with Matt McConnell earlier today because he called and wanted to know a little bit more about my background as he kind of wonders where his profession is going, where his professional career is going. But yeah, I think it's starting to really look at those hard questions of where they intersect and overlap. And as you say, any individual thing could be very rich and in and of itself, but it sort of limits you to from understanding the whole picture and the system and how it works. So I just, you know, thought that was a great way to maybe bring in something that I don't remember often talking about. You know, it's almost like we need a fourth course to just talk about, you know, how to study all of these and you know, or how to actually look at something in a way that doesn't, you know, privilege one of these over the others and does actually, you know, look at a bigger perspective. So,
Just to kind of talk about methodology too, like, I think as you know, in addition to us being educators, we're also learners, and we do privilege one form of learning over another. Some of us really do prefer a more tactile environment versus a more auditory environment, or however you want to dice it. We all have preferred areas that we like to prefer to learn in. As educators, it becomes very important to not only look at the way that we learn and perceive the way that our audience is learning through our lens, but to ask our audience directly. And I think that was one of the key reasons why I came back to get my PhD, was because a lot of what I was doing while I was getting evaluation, I felt was still getting it from either my perspective or a mainstream perspective, and I really wanted to get at what the audience was really thinking versus what I was assuming they were really feeling or how they were perceiving the programs or their connection to the environment.
I think that's really cool, Jenny. Can you say some more about that? I mean, I think I have an understanding of what you mean, but flesh it out a little more maybe for folks who are newer to that and maybe still even struggling with, well, what is the difference between evaluation and research and these different lenses of the educator, the resourcer, or researcher versus the audience themselves?
Okay. Well, forgive me for going off. This is not a tangent, but I'm going to use this as an analogy. But this is just something that I've been recently watching documentaries on. But it's about the Rosetta Stone and hieroglyphs. When they were first discovered in the hieroglyphs, no one knew what they could be read. And then the Rosetta Stone came into play. And when scholars, mostly in Europe, were looking at trying to translate them, many thought that they were just pictures, that they were symbols like a stop sign or, you know, like we see a yield sign. We know that those are symbols, give us an idea of a behavior or a certain idea that we want to portray. And so many scholars thought that. And so every time they were hitting the hieroglyphs or they were perceiving the hieroglyphs, they were looking at it with these symbols. Oh, this must be a bird. Oh, this must mean this. But they weren't really thinking of it as a language. They were thinking as pictographs. Well, as research was further going on, eventually it came to light that it was actually like a photograph. So there was actual phonemes to each of the hieroglyphs. And it was a language that was spoken. But it took many years, you know, for people to finally come around to actually accepting that it wasn't just these pictures, it was an actual language that was written on there. The same can be said for when we approach a certain program or a certain activity that we've been doing for a long time in our institutions. We may be perceiving it in the way that we were like, yes, of course, if the kids are smiling, if the kids are touching animals in the touch pool, if the students are regurgitating, a certain answer, then they're learning. But what it really takes for us to do is to actually move away from that perspective and then start asking students, families, audience members, what it is that they're really getting, what message are they really getting out of that information? And that really helps us then get, are we truly being successful at the message that we're trying to portray? Granted, many of our institutions prefer finding out if our current level of delivering programs is successful. And so evaluation is very effective at getting at our current level. If we've done a lot of research and based our programs on sound ideologies and theories, and evaluation is a great way to maintain or to build or show us areas where we can grow on our programs. But if you really want to challenge our programs a little bit, then you do have to actually take a step back, and that's where research comes in and takes a little longer time to get at, but can be, you know, can be something that would be very useful and instructful into the programs that we're actually creating.
Yeah, nobody ever seems to want to have a negative evaluation, you know, and in fact, you know, a lot of reporting is of what is successful rather than, like you say, you know, what's really going on, which may be successful in a different way, but not the way that we immediately think to measure it or think to look at it. I mean, you know, historically in education, like you say, regurgitating facts was actually like, oh, you're learning. But now we've, you know, come to understand it so much more deeply as, you know, attitudes and practices and beliefs and things like that. And so, you know, even starting to incorporate those in our evaluations is a step forward. But yeah, I think that's a really good point, and I really appreciate that analogy of the hieroglyphs, because I think it's really true. It depends on what you're looking for, what you'll find, right? So
exactly. You know, and John, you know, Falk and Dierkin, I mean, they've particularly John Falk has really talked a lot about identity, and mm-hmm. we know that people come into our programs and our institutions with a certain perception of who they are and who they are in this world. And that can't be, it has to be taken into consideration. So we can't assume that we're, you know, teaching blank slates and the moment, you know, in they walk and they will learn everything they know, everything they possibly want about geology in our 30-minute program. And we know that's not true. So, or that one experience will turn them around and make them become a geologist. It can be a pivotal experience, but it's not the one culminating experience. And I remember reading that in Lynn's work, Lynn Vierking's work, many, many years ago. And that was like a big aha moment for me, because I was like, oh, well, yeah, of course. I mean, you've thought it, but it took me reading it going, yeah, that makes so much sense. Of course, it's not one experience. It's multiple experiences building over time that creates how I perceive this particular theme. So, you know, I think that's also important to take into consideration as you evaluate your programs and or you do research, that there's an identity component that we may or may not get at. We can only do as much as we can, but that doing that work really helps us get out closer and closer to our understanding our audience and really delivering quality programs for them.
That's great. Great. Well, thanks, Jenny. We're starting to get some questions from our listeners, so I thought I'd take a second, make sure that we reintroduce for anyone who's just joining us. This is the week 3 or module 3 episode of SED 584, Physical Dimensions of Free Choice Learning. I'm your host, Katie Stouffer, with co-host Michelle Milam and our guest today, Jenny De La Hoz. And speaking with us about her experiences, especially as an educator for bilingual programs at the Monterey Bay Aquarium and now in her research with environmental educators of color, particularly Latinos. Michelle, anything to add before we get maybe to our questions?
Let's answer some of those student questions, make sure we have time to fit them all in.
Absolutely. Fit all of them in. I like your optimism. Well, I see one here from Jenny East on the chat, and she says, during your time at Monterey Bay or other programs, what strategies did you use to incorporate those who may not have had full use of their senses, like the main senses we often think of, vision and hearing, to support your experience, or their experience, excuse me.
So that's a great question, because when I first arrived, it became very evident that we didn't have enough people on staff that had personal experiences with any type of physical, mental, or emotional disability. So we reached out to local organizations, and actually it was Jim Covell who put together a panel of local experts to kind of walk us through what it would be like to walk at the aquarium if you had, if you had autism, for example, which is often a blind disability, or if you were hearing impaired or seeing impaired. And we learned a great deal about how to do things. One of the things we would do, for example, and I believe the education department at the aquarium has really improved on this, when we would have students that were blind would actually come into the classrooms, and we would walk them through with a feel through everything. So we would put out things that could be touched and wouldn't harm them in any way. And then we would slowly introduce animals and objects that we would teach them how to touch. And I have to say, this aspect of teaching how to touch, as we probably know in all of our institutions, is not something that's only pertinent to someone who is visually impaired, but is also pertinent to other people who may not know how to touch a particular object. So what we learned was anything that we do to make accommodations for special audiences actually augments the situation for our regular mainstream audiences. So that was one example. We've done hearing impaired situations. We've brought in people who are volunteers who do sign, or the aquarium did. And we also made, for visual impairment, but also for students with learning disabilities, we made a lot of our books bigger of print so that it can be easily read. So the best advice I can give you is to reach out to your local experts who would be happy to come in and give you an idea about how to cater to your local audiences. They know them better than anybody else.
Yeah, and I would say that, participatory design is as important here as anywhere. And like you say, actually asking folks who have diverse needs and diverse abilities, what resources they do have, because again, they're not blank slates. They may have a heightened sense of touch, and maybe they would be, a really good teacher for even your mainstream folks on how to touch, because they might rely on that even more. I want to just bring up a couple examples of things I've seen, particularly for touch in different modalities than the aquarium. That I thought were really cool. There was a woman, I believe she was at Johns Hopkins, made a couple of Braille books related to the Hubble Space Telescope imagery. And if anybody knows that much about the Hubble, it's just recently celebrating its 25th anniversary of operation of the Space Telescope, a huge success for NASA. These books, the Hubble images are all basically what we call false color, so they're not, if you're looking out into deep space, you don't see these brilliant colors. You take the different wavelengths that are being emitted from space to actually create these beautiful multicolored images. And so the woman whose name escapes me, and I should be looking this up while I'm here, created different textures for the different shapes that were that came out of the different wavelengths of lights and things that were colored differently. And I'm pulling it up here. Yeah, it's called Touch the Universe. Noreen Grice. And I was fortunate to work with her and a little bit while I was at the Maryland Science Center myself. And then she also has one called Touch the Stars, a similar sort of thing. And the other group that is doing some really interesting work in this area, I think, is the Geological Society of America. They have definitely a working group on diverse abilities. And for anybody who knows anything about geology, that is one of the science courses that incorporates field work almost more than anything that I've ever come across. And, you know, a lot of time going out and looking at rocks and sketching rocks and things like that. And so you can imagine someone who is visually impaired would have a really different experience. But again, just because it's different doesn't mean that they couldn't offer a lot of perspective that in turn would help, you know, even our mainstream learners, you know, because I think as experts, we forget that it was easy for us to learn and, you know, we can break things down in some ways, but that may not make sense to all our learners, and often taking advantage of our other, of the expertise of these other groups can really make a difference. So,
love that.
Thanks, Jenny. I really appreciate that question. And it looks like Amber is starting to write a question.
Katie, before she enters hers, maybe I can just kind of spin off of that. So, Jenny,
please.
One thing that I emailed you about in regards to doing the show was this idea. We had students share an experience that was particularly memorable for them, where they had to engage a sense other than vision. So is there one that you have engaged in as a learner and not so much as a leader of an activity that you would share with us?
You know, when you wrote that question down, I had to really think about it because I couldn't think of one experience. But honestly, this is going to sound absolutely crazy because it's not about engaging one experience, but it's about another level. So one of the volunteers at the aquarium, she had worked with kindergartners for a very long time and often was considered a Miss Frizzle by her students. And the one experience she had us do was to walk around the aquarium at a kid's level on our knees, holding an adult's hand. And that was so eye-opening. Because first of all, how often parents are dragging kids by the arm. But, you know, second of all, how everything looks like from that level. And, you know, and I had gone around the aquarium in a wheelchair, and that was interesting. But going down on my knees was a whole different level. And so while it's not one complete sense taken away, this idea of just looking at your institution at a different level was very eye-opening. And it gives you a different perspective as to what kids are looking at that you're teaching.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great point, because how often, you know, so many of us either as educators at a site or as people who may watch volunteers interact, you know, as that role, we often think that we have to go down to a certain level to address, you know, children than we do standing more upright to address an adult. And that certainly does change also how the physical space interacts with the child or, you know, somebody at a lower level. So that's a great example.
That's certainly a new lens for sure.
Yeah.
It was eye-opening how much I was dragged around the aquarium. That was also eye-opening. I was like, oh, well, this is new. This is what a 3 or 4-year-old feels like. Okay, I got it, you know? So.
Yeah, I'm just going to interject that I really wish there were a little more that we talk about with smell and taste. And I think, unfortunately, there's a lot more, certainly with taste, that we can get into. Some medical issues, you know, peanut allergies would be like the least of it. And I know we do some smell boxes and things in science centers. I was really hoping that Laura could talk to us a little bit about, you know, smells and nature. And I don't know, Jenny, how much you might be able to contribute to that idea. But, you know, it seems like we focus on maybe the big three, even when we go in the museum to touch and you know, I would challenge people to do more, and obviously through this assignment, we're doing more with smell and things. But
Yeah, you know, one example, I believe I shared it as a comment to one of the students in the certificate course, was the free choice learning retreat that we did a few years ago, and Laura and Susan O'Brien took us on a night hike, and their point of that was really helping us engage our different senses, much like animals would, you know, so how ears are shaped to pick up sounds, and, you know, we're out here in the pitch black in the woods by where we were camping, you know, cupping our hands around our ears in different ways to try and pick up different noises, and that type of thing. And I think as environmental educators that we can reflect on and think about how impactful just some of those experiences are to making connections with nature, too, to understand how other animals survive in the wild and then our role in that. So that's another piece that kind of came up in the certificate side of the discussion.
I think that both of those, you know, like the hearing and sound thing that you're talking about, Katie, is something that hasn't been explored that is very tangible in other cultures and their connection to nature. I think that, for example, sound is something that is often been part of the whole Asian culture and the way that that nature has been perceived, and sound has been used as alliteration in poetry. But it's not something we've explored in Western environmentalism, and neither is taste. Often when people are talking about nature and their connection to nature, you know, the first thing I often hear from anyone from different cultures, especially when they were coming to the aquarium, is how good something tasted. So I remember this Hmong class came, and they were 6-year-olds, and the class was predominantly Hmong. And so no one spoke English, so there was someone who translated for me. And we did a touch pools program. And I remember the kids pointing out to me the different animals that we eventually had them look at. And they were like, this one tastes really good in soup, this one not so much. And taste was such an important way that they connected to nature. And it was beyond the food thing. It was the way that they were connected to nature.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think Michael Liu did a little bit of that with Chinese speakers as well. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Cool. Well, so now Amber's got a question that takes us back a little bit to the fear question. She's wondering whether in your work, Jenny, that you've encountered similar types of fears that you talked about earlier from parents that have had children who grew up in nature, perhaps in the country, but then when they're invited into urban free choice learning experiences. Did I get that right, Amber? And then subsequently how you might have addressed some of those fears in a different or similar manner.
So is the question asking from parents who live in urban environments taking the kids out to nature, or kids who live in rural communities taking them into urban landscapes?
I think it's the latter. Hopefully Amber will chat in and make sure. Yeah. So she says when children grow up in nature but are invited into urban free choice learning. So
so that is a tough one to navigate, because there may be a couple of different things at play in there that are honestly in play as well when people come from, you know, urban areas to more rural areas. First of all, there's the fear of the unknown. And in that fear of the unknown, depending on the parent's cultural, ethnic background or socioeconomic background, there may be a component there of things that they may never have wanted to expose their kids to. So if they wanted if they purposely grew their kids up in a rural area, it could be, you know, attributed to them not wanting to expose their kids to high violence, highly perceived sexuality, anything that they may perceive as danger that they may perceive as part of a large urban environment. So the first thing to find out would be, what are the real fears that the parents are getting at? this type of work that I'm talking about is not easy work, and it's not something that you can do overnight. It's something that unfortunately does take time, and those of us that have been in the field know that sometimes this time is something that we don't get paid for. But if you do the work early, you can actually use some of this work later on, so it does save you time eventually. But anyway, going back to this, finding out what the initial fears are. Is there fear of, you know, hypersexuality? Is there fear of drugs? Is there fear? What is the fear of the parent? If the fears are nothing beyond those that you can control, where you can say, we're going to be very vigilant about this situation to avoid that. But the fear is more of the unknown, that their child is going to go beyond their knowledge, what the parent actually knows or understands, then that has to be honored as well. And so honoring that by saying, I see how this can be fearful if you yourself have never been to the city, and explain how, you know, express a similar situation where you may have been in a similar situation. So that way they understand that you understand where they're coming from. But acknowledging that often allays a lot of fear that their concerns are acknowledged and that you will do everything in your power to keep, to make sure that their child comes back and communicates what happened. And then that's the last thing that needs to happen. We need to build into our programs the opportunity and the experiences for children to be able to go back to their families and talk about what they've done with us. Often, and this is very true of urban kids going out into rural areas, but it's also true of rural kids going into urban, they don't have the language to communicate back with their parents or their families about their experience. And so if in our programs we build opportunities for us to talk with each other, they practice with each other, with us, about their experience, then when they go home, if they're provided that opportunity in their home, they can explain to their parents about their experience. And that then enriches them, not only the experience for the student, but also then broadens our doors and actually brings our program beyond our institutional walls and into the walls of the home, which is really where we want our programs to go eventually. So it's a great question, but I think you treat both of them very similarly by acknowledging fears, understanding where they're coming from, acknowledge the capacity of that their children may be going beyond what the parents' experience may be, and finally, really building into our programs opportunities for kids to know how to express their experiences to each other, to themselves, to each other, and finally their families.
Thanks, Jenny. That was really insightful, and I like the way you brought that back to, you know, having the kids extend their experiences, because I think that's a real powerful way that, you know, especially when we think of things like institutions of museums as places that people have to come to, but how do we, you know, reach beyond our walls? And it brings to mind a program that Extension here at the University of Florida has. I'm basically buying a little time in case Amber wants to comment on what you said there. But Extension has some a great deal of nutrition programs, and they've recently been sending home surveys with students to see what reactions they're getting from the parents when they take these nutrition information programs home and talk about them with their family. And I think they're getting some pretty good responses. And, you know, that's a little bit easier for something that's done in a formal school, maybe because they're doing this program, I believe, over like a 6-week period or something, and they're getting buy-in from the families beforehand to actually, you know, or the families are made aware of it. So I don't know if you were referring there specifically maybe to groups that were coming in as school groups, where maybe we would have an opportunity to do some pre-visit work even with the families, or even send a letter home with the families or something, if that's what you were kind of talking about. But I think it's an interesting, a really interesting place to explore, and something I'm trying to do with my work is how is it extending beyond the people that we reach immediately in the program and you know, going out to their friends and family. So.
Yeah, I you know, for me, I really came to this in my work, especially towards my time at the end of the aquarium, that I called it the Bugs Bunny approach. And that's, if you ever watch Bugs Bunny nowadays, you realize that there was actually two levels of jokes that were being thrown.
Uh-huh.
It's the same joke, but as an adult, you're like, oh, that means something a little bit different than I remember it being when I was a kid, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so what I then started building into some of my programs was that there were two audiences I was really gearing at, and one was my student audience, my child, my K-12 audience, and then my adult audience. And so sometimes my adult audience was present and I could use them to help me facilitate or bring them a message. Or sometimes my adult audience and or family audience was not present, and so how did I then bring them the information further on? Chris Parsons has mm-hmm. done some work like this. She did something at a park in San Elijo, and which was all about communicating this information to families in their homes. And so mm-hmm. we can start thinking about our programs really extending beyond the 15 minutes, 30 minutes, hour, even week-long or, you know, year-long programs, but really extending them to how do we bring these messages and help these kids become our messengers of whatever message we want to get into the home, how do we get it there? And it really then changes the way that you start programming stuff.
Mm-hmm. And it really can maybe change and hopefully overcome some of those fears of the physical space. And, you know, that would be really, really powerful if they have an ambassador that they're, you know, closer to, perhaps, that could then take them back. So, Amber...
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to tell you, Amber works at the Bishop Museum in Honolulu, so I'm assuming she has quite a few of these sorts of visitors that are coming into the big city of Honolulu. And she just said thanks, and it was... she likes the connection with emotions and known and unknown space, and is making her think about how she can incorporate maybe subsidies to bring, you know, parent-child dual field trips when she can, but also extend it when she can't. So, yeah.
Yeah, the Bishop Museum is a wonderful, wonderful institution. It's such an interesting dynamic that she has there with the different populations she has to work with over there. I encourage her in her challenge. That's a good challenge to have. I think in particular with what I know of as far as the Hawaiian population and the Native populations, it's really the element of respect, and Amber will understand this, is there's an element of respect for, Native beliefs and beliefs of the land, and then how to then bring that to modern day, and that there's a tension there that I think even modern day Polynesian researchers are trying to find. So my hat's off to her, because that's a tough one, but Bishop has done a great job up to this point, so I'm sure they'll continue to do a great job.
Yep. Well, so we've got about 6 minutes left and no more student questions. Michelle, I didn't know if you wanted to bring up something that we hadn't touched on, or if, anybody else has any kind of closing wrap-up comments. I've got kind of a couple of maybe funny examples to close out on fear if we don't. But
I really can't think of anything, so...
Okay.
I'm okay if you want to take it away.
I wanted to say something about the emotions and something that you had said it before, Katie.
Yeah.
So this is an example of something that just happened this past summer. I did a fellowship with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and I was helping out at a refuge. They have a week-long summer camp for kids to go out into the refuge, and it's like a day camp, and the kids come. And it's all run by volunteers. And so the volunteers had very limited experience with some of the new audiences emerging in the Portland area, particularly the Latino audience. So they asked me to come and help with possible couple of new campers that they were going to have. And sure enough, this mother showed up with these two cute as can possibly be twin sisters, ages 6. Oh, my goodness, couldn't be cuter than any – they were just super cute. And they were supposed to come with a cousin, but they wound up not coming with the cousin because the cousin's mother got scared about what could possibly happen at the refuge. And so these audacious and pioneering family decided to, well, what the heck, we don't care. We're going to try it out. What can be so dangerous? And they went out and they did the camp. 2 weeks later, they offered a camp again, and then this mother and their daughters became ambassadors for the refuge and the camp, talking to their cousins, and it wasn't just one cousin that came, multiple cousins came, about what the camp was about. And so it's about finding those pioneering individuals in communities that are also connectors that allow you to really help you, help inform you about what possibly the audience could be thinking, but also then can then be turn around and be ambassadors for your programs and what is there to fear and what is there not to fear about the program. So it was wonderful to see that.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that's, you know, it's another way that we can really multiply our efforts because, you know, if we had to go into every single community ourselves and build up trust one-on-one, you know, but if you can identify, in Extension we talk about like key opinion leaders or things like that when we talk about like adoption of innovations and things like that. I think that's, you know, could be really relevant to reaching some of these new audiences. And probably the reason that you need this is to really, you know, deal with those emotions of the, you know, the fear of the unknown and things like that. And so I think that's really, really cool. So, well, Amber and Jenny are chatting here about how cool you are, Jenny DeLose. So they're quite appreciative of your perspective today, as I am, and I'm sure Michelle is. And you know, it's always a great conversation to check back in with folks. And I love the radio show because it gives me an opportunity to do this when I, you know, have these kind of extended conversations, and that I, you know, you kind of get wrapped up in the everyday of research and sort of lose what's really beautiful about you know, really learning these things and making a difference, and really I think renews your spirit, if I can go off on a little bit of, you know, emotion of my own here for a second. But we got about 2 minutes left, but I just wanted to bring up as a probably something we should have dug into for quite a while if we really had the time. But when we first started talking about fears of nature and things, you know, I was immediately thinking about the times that I've been to parks and things lately where the signs that are supposed to protect you are like horribly, horribly terrifying. Like there's one at the Great Falls in Virginia that's like, okay, 90 seconds left. The sign literally, I believe, says, "If you fall in, you will die." And it's like, wow, you're trying to orient these people that, my God, maybe they've never been to a park, and okay, you see the sign, the official thing, you know, it's like, you're going to die if you just, you know, I'm just like, and then the tsunami signs I find kind of terrifying too. And so, I mean, I don't know if actually a good motivator or not, but man, the role of fear in that signage and like, I don't know.
Katie, I think you're talking about a new module that we can have people go around taking pictures of signage that scares you.
You know? You know, that would be a great assignment, you know? Oh, man. All right. Well, I would love to see somebody, maybe they could do that for their final prototyping assignment. Go out to a park and try a different sign and see how people react to it. But
it's a great idea.
Well, we got 30 seconds left. Thank you all again. Thanks so much for the student questions this week. I really, Amber has one last comment. She's had a lot of great discussions with teachers in Hawaii where it's a challenge even in the formal classroom due to fear. So, and a few scary signs in New Zealand. So we'll wrap it up. Thank you all again. And we'll see you next time. So
Thank you so much for coming in last minute.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, all right.
Oh, bye, ladies.
Have a good night.
Bye, Katie.
Good night.